Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Welcome back. And as a matter of fact, it's now or never. We've got a really special interview. They're always special, right? And so I'm interviewing Todd Callender, who is an international lawyer, and he has filed some really, really critical lawsuits. Now, this is a long interview that actually spans over, that'll span over the next show as well. So we'll be doing part two tomorrow. Now, Todd is an international lawyer, and he's actually had some very interesting lawsuits, but what really, you know, drew me to him were these lawsuits regarding the oath of office. Now, as everybody knows, we harangue all the time how important it is and how we need to use the oath of office against every one of our public servants. Well, it seems like we've got a lot of public servants, and there's some supposition that maybe all of them are failing to actually become true public servants because they do not actually take the oath or they do not do the legal process. Now, we're trying to run this down, and we need you to run this down as well. Now, I believe in Wyoming, in Gillette County, when they actually petitioned, these guys received. So I'm going to actually talk to Larry and Bill, the two primary drivers of the petitions in Gillette, because they received copies of the petition, or I should say the, help me out here, the oath of office from the county clerk. So we want to look at this. We want to make sure that these are legit, but really important. I have Mr. Callender's bio, Todd Callender's bio, on my other links. It's not the important information, but other links. This is where, when we interview people, folks, this is where we put all of their contact information and some details. And I put his bio because it's a pretty lengthy bio. In other words, he's been doing a lot of hard work, and most all of this is pro bono, especially on the Patriot side. And so it's a real privilege and an honor to have had an opportunity to meet this man. And so I'm hoping that we might be able to lend some assistance and hopefully even work with him as well as growing the movement together. Anyway, so we're going to go into break, and as soon as we come right back out of break, it's going to kind of linger out and we'll go straight into the interview. And so bottom line, once the interview is over, we'll be coming right back to basically say goodbye. And again, part two will be tomorrow. So we'll be right back after this short promo with Todd.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's, and if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Now we're going to just join with Todd in the conversation as it already was transpiring. So here we go, folks. This is Todd Callender.
You know, an interview is absolutely worthless if you don't record it.
So, well, this is true.
So the question I have is, actually, let me just start off with, do you have a bio that you'd like me to you know, provide to the listeners, or do you want to give me an intro?
Yeah, well, I can do both.
Okay.
Let me just dig one up for you. I've done quite a few of these things, so it seems like I've got some box standard ones, if that's all right.
Yeah, that's fine.
And I appreciate you taking the point, Drew. I would love to know more about your background.
I'd be happy to do that, but what you're doing with the oaths lines up a lot with what we do with First Amendment petitions, because First Amendment petitions are directly integral to every public servant's oath. And as you probably know, the First Amendment allows us, actually, it protects our right to petition government for the redress of grievances. And so...
Yep.
What you may not know is that there's actually teeth in the law that the government has no longer acknowledged and or even complies to. So, surprise, surprise.
No, nothing surprises me anymore. Our entire federal government is ridiculous. God, I know because I've tested it. on more than one occasion. I just filed an en banc appeal to the Tenth Circuit. The entirety of the Tenth Circuit, right?
Uh-huh.
And so it's a game of cat and mouse. So while I'm beating up on them in the Tenth Circuit in, a court system that is defunct, where almost none of the judges have a valid oath of office, I'm trying my case to the court of public opinion, which is the real court, mm-hmm. in the meantime. So, yeah, I get it. It's a duopoly. I have zero doubt about what it is you're going to share with me, because I've lost all inhibition as it relates to weird and truth.
right. So the Constitution, the language in the Constitution in Article 6 is really clear that all judges and all congressmen, senators, and even all public servants at the local level that are representatives to the people, because it doesn't really specify down at the states, but usually the states pass laws that require everybody that is elected.
They do.
Yes.
And did you look at 5 U.S.C. 333, 331 in the legislative history in particular?
No, I don't look at the statutes. Because a lot of times the statutes can be modified that don't actually live up to the law. And I'll give you a good case in point.
Sure.
The Supreme Court no longer uses in their language of their oath of office the support of the Constitution, that they will actually support the Constitution.
Wow. I've got to look at that, because we just FOIA'd the Supreme Court justices' oaths. And there is a special oath, I know, that goes with judges. But I think there's a special oath just for the Supreme Court justices, and that makes sense to me.
Well, so constitutionally, I'm just.
But what I wanted to say, hang on, before you go,
go
on,
ahead.
What I wanted to say is the legislative history is fascinating. That's what I wanted to direct your attention to. As you read through it, why do we have oaths? I know you know the answer to that question, but that statute was really built in 1865 after the Civil War, because you had half of the country that needed to be, integrated into the other half. How did they ensure that people were going to have an allegiance to this prospect called the United States? So that's where this was born.
Uh-huh.
This particular statute was
right.
born. So anyway.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
So let me ask you this, because you probably have never spent a lot of time reading the annals of Congress and, what were the acts of Congress and so forth. But since we're talking about it, you'll be able to quickly guess what the very first act of Congress was. In other words, when Congress finally got together for the very first session, usually the very first thing they do is what they would consider is the most important thing. And guess what the first act of Congress was?
Well, the establishment of the government is the first act, because you don't have one without it.
Well, actually, the first act of Congress, the first act, their official first act, was the administration and the execution of the oaths of office.
I bet you that's the second act. But okay, fine. I mean, you have to have a government, right?
Right.
It makes sense to me what you're saying. Okay. Well, it's also, by the way, bearing in mind that at that time we had who running around? you know, the turncoat himself, the most famous turncoat ever?
Hamilton?
No. No. Who was the general that, turncoat, what was his name? Oh, dear God.
You're talking about Benedict Arnold?
Benedict Arnold, that's right.
But he was in England at the time when we went to the Constitution.
He was the guy that ratted out, it was Washington, as a matter of fact. It was going for, was it Bunker Hill? In any event, yeah. But that, okay, we agree, oaths are important, so
right.
Carry on.
So, as a matter of fact, during the ratification debates, that was one of the key things that actually converted some of the anti-federalists, such as James Monroe. James Monroe was absolutely, so impressed that he says, you know, based on this one thing alone, it means that we legally have, you know, an obligation that they cannot, you know, just do what they want to do. They're obligated to support this Constitution. And that really made a huge difference.
They have a duty, right? That's the issue. And this is what I keep saying, is one of the reasons why we believe nobody's got their oath is because without it, if you look at the jury instructions for sedition and treason, you have to prove their duty. How does one do that?
Right. Absolutely. So what you have, and so here's the question, because I have some listeners, because they've been prompting me, and I just finished going through the ratification debates. My show, if you haven't listened to it, I actually go through the documents and read them. I don't want people to take my word for it. We actually go through them and highlight them. So the people, you know, we don't, you know, from cover to cover, but I give them the ones that are really critical, that really help people understand what this clause in the Constitution means. So what we're trying to do is empower people with this level of knowledge so that they become very dangerous.
Yes. Well, we make them into restorationists is the way I see it. Right? It's too easy for the three-letter agencies to call us terrorists and whatnot. They made that very simple.
Uh-huh.
So I keep harping on the restoration of the republic,
right.
Restorationists.
Right.
And I love that. And I think that's, I wouldn't even use the word dangerous, but albeit I understand what it is you're saying. We're really raising up our countrymen to restore our republic. And I really think that's at hand, by the way.
Right. So
we're there.
Yes, we are. And one of the things I try to communicate at the grand scale to my audience, they hear this all the time, I basically tell them it's we the people that have the blood on our hands. We actually have a self-governing system. And those people who are really familiar with the Constitution understand that the reason we have a Second Amendment is because Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15 basically says Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. In the ratification debates, this is how this was really well defined. The whole point of the standing army, that we couldn't have a standing army, wasn't just to have a military force. The standing army was to ensure that the government could not enforce their own laws. They talked about the king and the mischiefs that the king would do when he used his army to basically keep the people from foraging in the forest and gathering food or what have you.
Yes.
And right. So they wanted to make sure that the only entity that had the authority to execute the laws of the Union was the people themselves. This is a level of checks and balances that most people don't even realize.
It is. Can I just add to what it is you're saying right now? I don't know if you've had the chance. I assume you're familiar with Article 10 and how that governs military operation, amongst other things. 10 U.S.C. 252, put into effect March 17, 2021. Do you know what it says? It's the invocation of the Insurrection Act, by the way.
Okay.
Whenever the president considers that unlawful obstructions, combinations, or assemblages, or rebellion against the authority of the United States make it impracticable to enforce the laws of the United States in any state by ordinary course of judicial proceedings, he may call into federal service such of the militia of any state and use such of the armed forces as he considers necessary to enforce those laws or to suppress the rebellion.
Right.
That was invoked. That's in effect. That is what Trump did.
Uh-huh. And
that it said militia. I'm buttressing your point.
Yeah. So,
but,
Okay, so actually, the insurrection, because if you really look at Section 3, are you familiar with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment?
Yes, I am, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
Fire away.
Yeah, so Section 3 clearly lays out that all public servants are obligated, other than the president and the vice president. So it includes judges, senators, representatives, and everybody at the state and local level that is sworn to take an oath to support the Constitution. When they take that oath, they are obligated to step in and support that Constitution. To be clear here, when we look at support, you can use this in different terms, legal terms, and technically a wall, a supporting wall, is a very passive role of support. The support that is required is an active role, because Madison clarified this in 1798 in the Virginia Resolutions. When it comes to the Constitution, those who are the parties to that compact, which are the state legislatures, they are not only obligated, they are duty bound to arrest the evil. Whenever the federal government or whenever anything is basically coming in trying to pervert or subvert the Constitution, then they're supposed to step in.
I just sent you a bunch of stuff. I think it helps frame that as well. Yep. Keep going, man. I'm with you.
Okay, so if they fail to support the Constitution, then they've committed perjury. And Senator Howard, during the congressional debates...
But is it only perjury? Is that it? That's the limit of their culpability?
No. They could have actually committed a crime as well. Section 3 is not a criminal punishment. It is an eligibility measure, because it basically states that no person can be in office if they've taken an oath and they have failed to support the Constitution, or have failed to, or if they've given aid and comfort to the enemies of the Constitution. And so, in other words, they are no longer eligible once they have failed.
That's right. And I think that's a misprision of sedition, by the way.
Well, but even more importantly, because most people don't fathom this, because the concept of impeachment was a standard and a process used to get rid of somebody if they did all, you know, whether they committed a crime or violated their oath or anything else. Section 3 basically alleviates the need to go through the due process. It's a standard of eligibility. It's just like if a governor, while he's in the midst of governing the state, moves out of state, he is no longer eligible to be that governor.
It's a substitute due process, actually, is what that is.
Correct.
You're still giving them due process, but it's an alternate mechanism. It's done by the legislature, not by the courts.
Okay, so as we kind of peel this apart then, the question is, because many states, not all of them, but many states have actually created laws that basically pertain to that in some fashion, but they haven't done the due diligence in truly doing this. So the whole point of the petitions, because we're working in this, and I'm using this loosely, it's a little artistic license, we're creating a petition militia across the states.
What does that mean?
What that means is the weapon of choice is the First Amendment petition to hold our public servants accountable. In other words, you can hold your public servants accountable for your county commissioners, because they've taken an oath, which means that they have an obligation as the parties to the state compact. So stepping back a little bit, when we look at how the state compacts or the constitutions were created, out of all of the states, the first 13 states were literally created by the king, and then they converted into sovereign states, but they had counties, and they reformed after the Constitution into counties and basically redid their constitution. And every new state that joined the Union, the county sent delegates into a central place to form their government and to create their constitution, meaning that even though they didn't capture this well, and they were kind of illiterate regarding the U.S. Constitution, they weren't the framers that were standing up these new states, what they didn't realize is that the counties are the legitimate parties to that compact. And because they're the legitimate parties to the compact, they have the oversight and the responsibility. So this is why we go to this county supervisors and county commissioners, and we demand, because they're the lowest echelon. They're the ones that are in, you know, we can get into their face. We don't have to drive out of town to go talk to, you know, our state legislators or Congress. They're our representatives who are under the same oath, and we demand that they can actually step in our behalf, and they can present petitions in our behalf to the state legislature and recommend or push them to do the same to Congress. In other words, it's kind of like following the chain of command. You must push this forward. And if they basically stonewall, they try not to do anything, then they have literally violated their oath of office and are no longer eligible to be in office.
If they have one, and the reason I say that is, you know, this whole journey started for us in the Western United States when I was helping a bunch of ladies in Colorado, west of Western Slope, trying to take over their school boards and county board of commissioners. And what we came to find is that the sheriffs and all these people didn't have any oaths of office because we were doing bond claims. And the insurance company would say, they didn't take an oath of office, we're not on the hook. That's where this all came from. So the answer to your question is yes. So let us assume that your board of commissioners, none of them have an oath of office. Then what? Are you going to get the sheriff to go and arrest them?
Well, so I know Washington State does the oath of office, and I know Missouri does.
Colorado does. That's where I'm licensed, by the way, as a lawyer.
Oh, okay. So Colorado has the oath. It's still legitimate, but they're not using that. So these whole bonds.
No, this is the point. They have to use it. They are acting ultra-virously without it. The problem is that when you go to say, okay, you can go civilly or you can go criminally. Civilly, you don't have an oath of office. What are you doing here? You have no right to be here. You can sue them even in their personal capacity. But secondarily, you could go up to their bond, and the bonding company, I think it was Prudential in Colorado at the time, said, well, they don't have an oath, so we're not on the hook. So good luck with that one. Then you end up in a criminal case. You've got somebody impersonating a state official. That's a crime. And you go to the sheriff, and you file a criminal complaint. And yeah, we don't care. We're not going to do anything about it. And because we came to find half the sheriffs don't have a written oath of office either. I had to resurrect the Colorado constitutional amendment victims' rights statute, believe it or not, to force a police chief in somewhere Colorado to actually accept a criminal complaint. He wouldn't touch it. He closed the police station and ran out the back so that he could avoid being served with a criminal complaint. All we wanted was a case number. This is where this is the trenches we're dealing with, and that was almost 3 years ago.
Right. So it's interesting. I guess you can use the court itself, but are you telling me
the county court?
Well, yeah, probably. So I believe common law is the law of the state of Colorado.
Well, in theoretically,
yeah,
it is. But there's statutory law, administrative law. All of that is put into place. So you can plead common law you want to in a county court, but they're going to look to the statutes. I mean, case law is common law, and it does apply. If you've got precedent, the Colorado Court of Appeals, and the Colorado Supreme Court, they'll look at that and they'll treat it right as being primary authority or even mandatory authority that comes from the Supreme Court. But common law only in the sense that it's juxtaposed to the actual writing of the statutes or the regulations in place. They will not obfuscate statutory law in place, period.
Well, so if the statutes are in violation of the Constitution, then that becomes
the
problem.
You sue them for violation of the Constitution, and the Colorado Supreme Court will look at those things. They have historically.
But so the question is: are your Supreme Court and is your court apparatus, are they under oath or are they under bond? Because it sounds like
never
the corruption.
Looked that far.
It sounds like the corruption goes all the way.
It does. So starting in, this is what we traced it back to. 1963 on January 10, into the congressional record by a senator from Kentucky, if memory serves, was the Naked Communist, otherwise known as the Communist Manifesto, read into the congressional record. It has 45 items, agenda items, to turn the United States into
I'm familiar,
a communist state.
Familiar with the book. Yep.
From that point in time, but that's read into the congressional record. Right? It's now part of the official record of the statutes of that date and year. From that point in time, we can't find valid oaths of office from anybody. We haven't found them since. Item number 13 of the Communist Manifesto is to eliminate oaths of office. So then you got JFK is killed November 22 of that year. It appears from 1964 on, they just stopped requiring the oaths of office to be notarized, to be sworn. So you might find an oath of office for an appointee, but it's almost never notarized. I've seen one, as a matter of fact, from Judge Bierman Jackson in Washington, D.C. Circuit. It's the only one I've seen so far. All the other ones are witnessed, but they are not notarized. They are not sworn. They are not sworn under penalty of perjury. Means that they are not sufficient. They are not best evidence for purposes of trying somebody for treason or sedition.
Right. Okay. All right. So it's your estimation then that this is permeated throughout the union.
It's my conclusion.
So I was just talking to the chair of the Constitution Party of Missouri, and this past session, when they were read in, because it was the beginning of a two-year session, they were all sworn in, and they actually, some states actually have the swearing in done by the local court or what have you, that you need to be sworn in before you show up. And anyway, this gentleman always goes down to the state house and watches everybody get sworn in.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that. But what you will find is this is two parts, right?
Okay.
Swearing in this way is all fine and well, but for purposes of the statutes applicable, it does not count. There must be a written sworn attestation in front of a notary as to their duties.
Uh-huh.
Raising your right hand on a Bible doesn't count by itself.
Okay. I would have to go through the acts, and it doesn't really matter, because I'm okay with actually making laws more stringent. I'd have to go through the very first act to see how it evolved.
Those are the federal laws. You may find states have different parts to them. That some may require it to be sworn, some may not, but some require it to be. In fact, I think they all require that it has to be written. But I haven't looked at all 50 states. I'm just telling you from a federal law point of view. Uh-huh. Raising your hand doesn't count. It's got to be written, and it's got to be in front of a notary.
Yeah, well, I know you also have to, I think, sign, especially for an affirmation. An affirmation you have to sign. So there's no doubt that it probably evolved.
This is my point. Yeah. No, this is my point. We haven't found one other than whatever her name is, Jackson, the judge in the D.C. Circuit. What I'm saying to you is that the entire cabinet of the U.S. government, according to the statutes I provided you,
yep,
does not exist.
Right.
They have 30 days from the date that they're appointed to do this. None of them have. Some didn't even bother.
Right.
And the way the statute reads is that all of their acts are not official at all. They're void ab initio.
Yep.
So that means for at least these last 2 years, those are the ones we've looked at very carefully, none of these acts actually happened. And my conclusion is thus. That all relates to the corporation of the United States, right? That frankly went bankrupt. I think it was actually dissolved in 2018. There is no oath. There is no anything. This is all made up bullshit. There is no government. The Republic itself is comprised of the states, vis-a-vis the 10th Amendment. The Republic still exists, but Biden isn't the guy in charge of the Republic. He's the guy in charge of United States of America, Inc., bankrupt company. So what does it matter if there's an oath anyway? It all matters only on the basis that the public perceives it to exist, that they have the ability to print money ad infinitum.
Okay.
The debt ceiling was removed.
So
right? And people will use their fake tender for goods and services, but
right.
It has no substance at all. It's just
okay,
belief.
So Todd, the question is, even though, because I understand that they formed corporations, and they did that without the constitutional authority to do that.
That's right.
And so the corporations have been defunct and bankrupt. Does that mean that the Constitution is still not the supreme law of the land?
No, it means that there's two different governments. There's the real one, which is the Republic of the United States, comprised of the many states together.
Okay.
And then there is the corporation one, and that one doesn't exist. But the corporation one is the one spending all the money and confusing people with military operations and things around the world and making into agreements that they have no business making.
Well, so
or authority to make.
Right, so there you go. They have no
it's
authority to make. So in other words, because I can prove academically and constitutionally that they cannot make a treaty or a compact of debt to spend money on something they have no authority to do. In other words, every single one of these people are committing fraud, and we the people are not accountable for what they're doing. The American Republic does not owe that debt clock. And as a matter of fact,
that is right.
We can audit all of this and go all the way back to Wilson's plan of spending us into prosperity and prove that all of the money that they've spent and then some, they've actually stolen our wealth.
That's right. All of that's correct. All of that's correct.
Okay.
And by the way, there are some interesting moves afoot. So look into it yourself. I love the fact that you're a historian and you look into these things. I have heard from a very reliable source of research crap out of everything that not only was the Federal Reserve moved under the Treasury during Trump's tenure, but he also remains as a director of the Treasury, Mr. Trump. And I haven't had a chance to look it up, but I do believe that's probably true. The point of which is what we are seeing is the grand facade being revealed. I think Trump remains the real president of the Republic of the United States. And what we're seeing is the corrupt D.C. swamp monsters all revealing themselves for what they truly are. They are impersonating federal officials. That's a crime. We cannot prosecute them for treason or sedition or misprison of either, because we can't prove all the elements of the crime in so much that none of them have a written oath of office that's notarized.
Okay.
We're missing the element of the crime. But so, what we can do is put them in jail for impersonating federal officials, including federal law enforcement officials, whereby you Graves and the Attorney General, neither of them have a valid oath of office. The Attorney General doesn't even have an appointment date, and yet they're putting people in a January 6th gulag. You know, those are false imprisonment, amongst other things.
So let me ask you this. You probably haven't read our petition regarding the 12th Amendment violation and how Congress violated the Constitution on January 6th, 2021, when they allowed an unconstitutionally formed electoral college choose the president. Now, this is very interesting because Congress was served with First Amendment petitions. We have proof of receipt. Actually, Bob Schultz has all of this because he's the one I helped him do this. But Bob Schultz with the We the People Foundation has proof of receipt that Pence and everybody had been certified receipt of this petition informing them that the Electoral College was unconstitutionally formed because 31 states changed the manner of how they were to choose their electors, that process of how to do that, without using the state legislatures. Therefore, because they did that, only 138 electors were legitimate.
Got it.
And technically, all of these states still have that same law in effect. In other words, the state legislatures have not stepped in and actually corrected the problem.
Well, and why would they? This goes back to our whole point. You asked, are they all that corrupt? And the answer to your question is, yeah, they're all on the take. They've all been bought. Arizona is a great example. It's run by the cartels. There is no distinction between our government and the cartels. They're criminal enterprises.
So I know good legislators that are in South Dakota, in Montana, Wyoming. So I do know good legislators, and they are fighting a corruption within their state house. And I think there's no doubt in my mind they don't really know just how bad it really is. But nevertheless.
Start this way. It's my new litmus test. Do they have an oath of office? Is it written, and can I see it? They should frame it, put it on the wall.
Well, I will go back to each of them, and I will ask them, do they have an oath of office that has been notarized or whatever the state requirement is, right?
That's right.
Okay.
And it should be, and like I said, my litmus test for any sheriff, anybody that claims that they have some authority, they need to frame the damn thing and stick it on the wall so everybody can see it. In fact, I was asked by Jeffrey Prather a week ago, you know, what are the small steps we can do? We can start demanding this of our sheriffs, of our county officials, because I'm just like you said, look, I know you're right. You're absolutely right. It's a chain of command and it goes up that way. It goes uphill. So let us make the local people accountable. Where you're the board of supervisors, the county, or you're whatever, the mayor. Show me your oath of office. Demand it, because if they don't have one, they're not lawfully serving.
Yeah, and so this is how, I'm not sure if you're aware of Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims, and those cases, but this
not
is,
the top,
okay, so prior to the 60s, every state in the Union that in its Republican form of government had legitimate bicameral legislative bodies, where the counties were represented in the Senate, the county legislatures or the boards of supervisors, commissioners, their suffrage. And if you look at Article 5 in the Amendment Protection Clause of Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, the suffrage of the state is in the Senate. In other words, the senators are to represent the state legislatures. And technically, even though they may have changed the manner how they're chosen, they're still obligated to follow and vote and represent those state legislators. Because the 17th Amendment never changed Article 5. And technically, if you read that Amendment Protection Clause, it says that no state shall lose its equal suffrage in the Senate without its consent.
Very good.
And so technically, we have, what, seven states that never ratified or accepted the 17th Amendment. And just so you know, this would be probably something you'd love, is in 2010, the federal government allowed Delaware to change their rejection and actually ratify the Constitution and register it as a ratification. And in talking to John R. Vile out of Middle Tennessee University, I proposed this premise that that means that the door swings both ways, that every state should be able to actually change their position, and the federal government is obligated to accept it because they allowed that to happen with Delaware. And so what that means is we could actually rescind the 17th Amendment without having to repeal it. We could actually get states to change their positions to where they no longer have three-fourths of the states supporting the 17th Amendment. Now, they tried to do this with the 14th Amendment. If you look at the history, there were a few states that tried to rescind it, but the government did not allow that. There's no language in that amendment for that to happen. So the government would have to open that door on their own and say, we will allow that. And that's exactly what they did with the 17th Amendment. And you know the idiot, the convinced...
Who's they? Who's they that grants that authority?
The Congress, the federal government.
Well, the Congress meaning both houses?
No, actually, believe it or not, the Congress kind of controls this administration, because when you look at amendments, the ratifications come in and it's registered by an administrative body under Congress. And Congress allowed the administrative body to count that as an accepted change of the amendment. And you know where
the rulemaking authority.
But this happened in 2010. Guess who was the vice president in 2010, and guess where he's from?
You gotta be kidding me.
No, it was this stupid. I mean, if you want to be stupid, then I think we ought to exploit that. This is an opportunity, right?
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, I'm just sitting here thinking, where does Biden fit into this? Because he seems to be.
Yeah, he was the one that actually.
He was the guy.
He was the guy that basically, you know, I'll just say. Bullied or kind of just, you know, claimed, hey, you guys are idiots. How come you don't ratify this? Change this. And
he's from Delaware.
Right. That's right. And he basically kind of beat them with an ugly stick saying, we're better than that. We need to change our position. And it all happened. You know, I see, I don't know how you feel religiously, but I see the hand of providence. Throughout all of these things,
brother, I wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for God tapping me on the shoulder. I have no interest in having three jobs. I really don't. But here I am. I have three full-time jobs, and I'm tired.
Yeah, I get it. I completely get it. I've retired twice, and I still do this, and I do this for free. I don't do this to get paid.
Trust me, I've been working pro bono as a lawyer for 3 years now. All of this I've done is pro bono. Hundreds of thousands of people.
But so let me ask you this, because you have to mutually agree with me, that every time you make these advances forward, you have to look back and say, you know, this is truly a blessing from God. Because every time we do those things, he blesses us. And I tell people all the time, why are you denying yourself blessings when you can actually be contributing? Because God will bless us if we act. We act on faith and step in, because liberty is the integral building block of salvation. Every person must have the ability to choose for themselves to accept. And once that is gone, once they take full control and that is gone, then it's over. That's why he has to step in.
That's been their plan all along.
Yeah, it has been. So,
how did you find me, by the way?
How did I what come to be?
How did you find me?
Oh. So, I have a listener that is very, you know, astute to the, you know, not common news, and she said, "You got to talk to this guy." And I said, "Okay, I don't know how to get a hold of him," but then she just sent off the email because she was that. I'll just say that motivated to try to help to create this connection.
Well, that's cool. So you don't really know anything about it?
No, I didn't even know you were a lawyer. I heard that you were talking, and I go, he's absolutely correct. If they have not taken an oath of office, they are to be removed immediately in accordance with the Constitution.
Yeah. Go back and just type my name in, any search browser.
Oh, okay. And...
That's funny. So I've been at this fight. I published a criminal complaint to stop the shots, amongst other things, all the way back in March of 2020. The first month, there were 20,000 of them downloaded and filed across the U.S. I was the first guy to sue the federal government to try and stop the shots. I sued the DOD with a presumptive class of 210,000 plaintiffs.
Yeah, yeah.
At the end of the day.
Right. So the first thing that comes up with DuckDuckGo is Attorney Todd Callender. The vax genocide has likely killed a billion.
Yeah. So I've been really at the very front of this whole thing for a long time because, you know, God gives us these experiences in our lives, and we end up in these various places. So,
let me ask,
the writ quo warranto came later, right? I've been fighting with the Department of Defense, Health and Human Services, and the FDA now for three years, which includes, by the way, the revelation that we discovered in the process of this, that everybody that got the shots is actually a new species owned by the patent holders, and the DOD et al., the DOJ, will not deny that allegation.
Well, so maybe in every other country that doesn't have a constitution protecting them, and maybe under the color of law...
Funny you say that. That's what I alleged. I said, you can't do that. 13th Amendment outlawed slavery. You don't get to own people since 1865.
Right.
That's the issue in front of the Tenth Circuit right now.
Right.
On bunk.
And so one of the problems, and I'm sure you might be aware of this, and I don't know if you've gone down to litigate this, but no state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. And what that means is there can be no company, no corporation operating under the cognizance of a state and mandate that you have to have a vaccination, because that means that the state would have to enforce that rule, that policy, that law in a state court, where they would actually then be denying the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. No state shall make or enforce. And so, you know, the states really do have much greater control over the corporations. They're not private entities. They're operating under the cognizance and under the permission of the states. And so we actually have a petition that goes after any business that wants to deny people their First Amendment rights of petition, but we could easily do that same thing over vaccinations, over any type of thing where basically any corporation, business, doesn't matter if they want to start asking or crossing the line when it comes to our constitutional rights. It's the same thing with, like, social media. Social media is basically permeating all of this digital footprint on you, but we have a right to be secure in our persons. And they can't just be taking this. Even if we sign a contract, there in the United States, you cannot sign away your rights. That paper, that contract, is basically null and void under our Constitution.
Here lies the issue. Well, that is true. Who exactly is going to enforce that?
So when it comes down to who actually has the power, we have to wait.
I'm asking who is mechanically, physically going to do
it. It has to be the people. The people have to actually force their legislators. They have to force their. This is why we have to start at the county level and get them to take the stand. Because once we clean up the county, the state becomes easier. This is how we can, you know. I don't even think it. So, are you familiar with Martin Luther and what he did in 10 years? He basically.
Well, I'm not sure about what he did in 10 years.
So he basically pulled the Germanic states away from the control of the Catholic Church in 10 years. It was a 10-year process when he posted his 95 theses, and when they finally basically decided that they were going to reform Christianity. And that's when they went away from the Catholic Church, and he convinced not only the people, but the monarchies of the Germanic states. That was a 10-year process. I truly believe that if we act on faith and we actually engage and get the people engaged, we could actually take back our country in much less time.
I think that's what it takes. No, and I think that's exactly what it takes, which is frankly why we're talking. Is that point? Trust me, I don't have time to do this, but I am enjoying it. Unless people actually stand up and do this and demand, and it starts at the county level, just as you've envisioned. With what you're referring to as your militia, there is no savior coming. It has to be the people. And you see this on a global basis, because what's happening in the United States is not anecdotal. I'm outside the United States. I'm an international lawyer, funny enough. And all of this is happening in every country in every way at the same time. We've got to take our planet back, frankly, is the issue.
Yes, and it's Trevor Lawton, because I asked you if you knew Trevor Lawton. It's Trevor Lawton used to say, you know, the reason he, as a New Zealander, why he's here, because he knows if America falls, so falls the world.
Yeah, that's right. We're the last one. We're the last brick.
Yep. And the funny thing is, the funny thing is, the whole globalist movement has actually been sponsored and actually subsidized by the United States government.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Well, it's because, you know, at the end of the day, all of this is above governments. You know, like I said, I've lived outside the United States really for my adult life, and I've worked inside the belly of the beast, so to speak. And, you know, I'm in the international financial world. That's what I do for a living. So what I would tell you is that the people that make money up out of thin air own this planet. They own governments, they own militaries, they own it all. So we are caught in a stupid facade, thinking that governments actually count when in fact they don't. They're just pawns on a chessboard. So until we get past that, nothing is going to change. I would say, however, that in my estimation, the owners are no longer around. I think Trump and those guys actually took them out, because you and I wouldn't be having this conversation if they were still in existence. And not only that, but Vladimir Putin wouldn't be owning Astana as he is now, which they built to be their new home. To rule the world in the international financial sector under the Bank for International Settlements.
Yes. So let me ask you this question, because if you're involved in international law, and I've got a couple more
involved in it. It's what I practice.
I apologize. I don't mean to insinuate. I got about 2 minutes left, and then I have to basically extend this into the next interview. But,
sure.
When I look at the movements and everything else that are in America, I perceive that one of the most insidious and one of the most dangerous movements is the sovereign citizen movement. Because when a person actually declares that they're no longer a U.S. citizen, they've absolved themselves from the protections of that Constitution. And they've basically removed them.
But how do you make that distinction, you know, after the 14th Amendment? Because you have U.S., you have Americans, you have U.S. nationals, you have people of the birthright prior
to the creation of the 14th.
Yeah, so the 14th Amendment didn't create the corporations, though.
Who enjoyed all the rights and privileges of the Constitution. So how does that work?
So actually, when you look at the Privileges and Immunities Clause, it says that, that no state can make or enforce any law that infringes the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. That does not apply to inhabitants. And I think we just... Go ahead.
No, I lost you. You were telling, you were answering the question, and I'm sorry, the whole thing quit, and I don't know why.
Oh, okay. So let me repeat this. Then when we look at the 14th Amendment, the language is very clear that no state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. It doesn't include inhabitants.
Right.
Okay, the inhabitants and all
this is my point.
And the corporations did not come
US
from the 14th Amendment.
Existed prior to the 14th Amendment. I mean, this is my point. The 14th Amendment came long after the United States was a creation, a sovereign.
Yes.
It didn't give anybody additional rights. They already had their rights. It's not adding anything.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so there's no doubt in my mind that Mr. Callender actually has... a lot of you are probably thinking, because I criticize lawyers all the time, and they're not all bad. I don't mean to say that... Every single, there are always outliers, and as far as a lawyer goes, he's an outlier. Now, I will say this, he may actually know, and it would actually be, there'd be merit in trying to create a network of constitutional lawyers. I mean, not looking for a network of pro bono lawyers, but a network of lawyers that are demanding to restore our constitutional republic and place the government back into its delegated powers and strip away all of these powers away from the federal government and get them back to the states and or to the counties and so forth. So we're pretty much out of time here. And so we will be back with Mr. Callender tomorrow with the second half of this interview. He's obviously not your normal, as you know, like I just said, he's not your normal lawyer. And that the fact that he's doing all of this is just absolutely awesome. And it was a privilege to have the opportunity to talk to him and have this discussion. We will be back with the last half of that interview tomorrow. God bless. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. Thank you so much.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.